From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Faced with unprecedented resistance to his wars, President Bush is now calling for 92,000 more troops over the next 5 years. And in the State of the Union, he announced a major new initiative. He's calling it a Civilian Reserve Corps. But it's not actually Bush's idea. It's the brainchild of the head of a secretive mercenary firm based in the wilderness of North Carolina. Its name is Blackwater USA.
Journalist Jeremy Scahill on the privatization of war, then the coming robot army, and a look at the future of military weapons.
ADS uses a directed beam of millimeter wave energy that penetrates about 1/64th of an inch into the adversary's skin. ADS will minimize fatalities by providing our forces a non-lethal option between shouting and shooting.
The Pentagon unveils a new heat ray gun that's designed to make targets feel like they're about to catch fire. Its main goal, pain. Does it violate international law? Then eight former Black Panthers are arrested on charges related to the 1971 killing of a San Francisco police officer. They say they made false confessions after New Orleans police tortured them.
They beat me, they punched me, they kicked me, they spit on me. They called me a lot of vile names. And then they told me that they was going to kill me if I didn't cooperate with them.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Pentagon expands its deployment in Iraq, U.S. troops are facing a longer stay in Afghanistan. The Pentagon's announced more than 3,000 U.S. troops will have their deployment extended an extra 4 months. New troops could also be on the way. On Thursday, NATO's commander in Afghanistan, David Richards, said NATO's force will be increased.
More ISAF troops are being committed to this campaign. You will hear very good news formally very shortly on that. I anticipate at least another brigade of combat troops from ISAF nations coming here shortly, and more after that.
News of an expanded deployment comes as the Bush administration says it'll seek another $10 billion in military and civil aid for Afghanistan. The Washington Post's reporting the Bush administration has authorized U.S. troops to kill or capture Iranian operatives in Iraq. Officials say the policy is less part of a military strategy in Iraq than an effort to weaken Iranian influence in the Middle East. The kill or capture program was implemented last fall after the White House decided it was failing to isolate Iran's government. The administration implemented the strategy despite apparently receiving counsel it could lead to harmful retaliation against U.S. personnel. Now, Iraq's industry minister has announced the Iraqi government's in talks with oil giant Chevron and Exxon to build a $3 billion petrochemical plant in Iraq. The minister, Fawzi Hariri, says the talks are among several ongoing discussions with Western corporations. In other Iraq news, an army private's been sentenced to 18 years in prison after pleading guilty to killing two unarmed Iraqis near the town of Samarra last May. Under a deal with military prosecutors, Private Corey Claggett will be eligible for parole after 5 years. He's the third to plead guilty of four soldiers charged in the case. In Lebanon, Beirut was under military curfew Thursday after new clashes between government and opposition supporters. At least four people were killed and 100 injured in violence outside Beirut's Arab University. Speaking for the opposition, Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah appealed for calm.
I call on all the people from all the political spectrums to clear the roads and to have self-discipline and to be calm and to go back to their homes and to follow all the actions that are taken by the Lebanese army.
The violence comes as the Lebanese government won more than $7 billion in pledges at a donor meeting in Paris. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the Bush administration would ask Congress for $700 million in aid to Lebanese Prime Minister Fouad Sinoura.
But more than what this may do, what this money may do for infrastructure, for security reform, for economic support, we hope that the people of Lebanon will take it as an expression from the American people of our admiration for Lebanon, of our friendship for Lebanon, and of our belief in the ability of the people of Lebanon to overcome difficult times.
In Israel, President Moshe Katsav has been suspended as he faces an expected indictment for allegedly committing rape. On Thursday, dozens of Israeli women gathered outside Katsav's residence in Jerusalem, calling on him to resign. This is former Israeli Knesset member Eti Livni.
It's a disgrace to the Israelis, to the women of Israel, to the democracy of Israel. It shouldn't be any one moment there.
In Mexico, the local leader of Mexico's largest opposition party has been shot dead in the southern state of Oaxaca. Fructuoso Pedro Garcia was head of the Oaxaca chapter of the Democratic Revolution Party that narrowly lost last year's presidential race. The killing came 3 days after Garcia announced his candidacy for mayor in a local town. Democratic Revolutionary Party members have supported the popular uprising against Oaxaca State Governor Ulysses Ruiz. In Kenya, grassroots activists from around the world wrapped up the seventh edition of the World Social Forum. Tens of thousands of people gathered in Nairobi's Freedom Park chanting, "Another world is possible." The American actor and Trans-Africa Forum chair Danny Glover said the meeting continues to embolden activists to create change.
We must use all our power. We must use all we have to make sure that our governments respond to that atrocity. We must also respond to what the interests, what the global interests and what the regional interests are in the Horn of Africa, for the U.S., for the West, and for China. We have to respond to that. It is critical for all of us in every sector, from grassroots organizations, from civil society, and for governments to respond to what is happening on the continent.
This week's gathering was the first World Social Forum held in Africa. Back in the United States, the Bush administration has asked a U.S. appeals court to dismiss a lawsuit challenging its warrantless domestic spy program. The White House says the case is moot since it decided this month to seek wiretap approval from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Plaintiffs, including the American Civil Liberties Union, say they'll challenge the administration's request. New developments from the Lewis Scooter Libby trial. On Thursday, Vice President Dick Cheney's former spokesperson, Catherine Martin, testified she told Cheney and Libby of Valerie Plame's CIA status days before Libby claimed he found out. Libby is Cheney's former chief of staff. He's accused of lying to investigators and a grand jury during the investigation of the outing of Plame's identity. Martin also testified Cheney personally directed the White House effort to discredit Plame's husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, after Wilson challenged the Bush administration's pre-war claims on Iraqi weaponry. In Mississippi, a former sheriff's deputy was arraigned Thursday in a civil rights murder case dating back more than 40 years. James Ford Seal has been charged in connection with the 1964 murders of 19-year-old African-American hitchhikers Henry Hezekiah Dee and Charles Eddie Moore. Prosecutors credit Moore's brother Thomas for breaking open the case. Thomas Moore worked with the Canadian documentary filmmaker David Ridgen to pressure authorities to reopen the investigation 7 years ago. On Thursday, Thomas Moore spoke about his quest for justice.
I promised him in 2005 at his grave in Franklin County, Mount Holly Cemetery, that I would fight until I die. And I would do that. And when I got the word yesterday, just so happened David and I were speeding through Virginia, and I cry. Yeah. And I don't cry too much, but I cry.
And finally, tens of thousands of peace activists from around the country are gathering in Washington, D.C. Saturday for a massive protest against the Iraq War. Organizers United for Peace and Justice are predicting one of the largest anti-war rallies since the U.S. invaded Iraq nearly 4 years ago. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The private security firm Blackwater USA is back in the news. On Tuesday, hours before President Bush's State of the Union address, one of the company's helicopters was brought down in a violent Baghdad neighborhood. Five Blackwater troops, all Americans, were killed. Reports say the men's bodies show signs of execution-style deaths with bullet wounds to the back of the head. Blackwater provided no identities or details of those killed. They did release a statement saying the deaths, quote, are a reminder of the extraordinary circumstances under which our professionals voluntarily served to bring freedom and democracy to the Iraqi people. President Bush made no mention of the incident during his State of the Union, but he did address the very issue that's brought dozens of private security companies like Blackwater to Iraq in the first place, the need for more troops.
Tonight, I ask the Congress to authorize an increase in the size of our active Army and Marine Corps by 92,000 in the next 5 years. Second task we can take on together is to design and establish a volunteer civilian reserve corps. Such a corps would function much like our military reserve, would ease the burden on the armed forces by allowing us to hire civilians with critical skills to serve on missions abroad when America needs them.
Is the president looking to further outsource war? My next guest writes, Blackwater is a reminder of just how privatized the Iraq war has become. Jeremy Scahill is a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at the Nation Institute. He's author of the forthcoming book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. He has an op-ed piece in yesterday's Los Angeles Times entitled, Are Mercenaries in Iraq? Joining us now in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
It's good to be home.
We invited Blackwater on. They refused. But, Jeremy, let's talk first about Blackwater. What is it?
Blackwater is a company that began in 1996 as a private military training facility. It was built near the Great Dismal Swamp of North Carolina. And visionary executives, all of them former Navy SEALs or other elite special forces people, envisioned it as a project that would take advantage of the anticipated government outsourcing. Well, here we are a decade later, and it's the most powerful mercenary firm in the world. It has 20,000 soldiers on the ready, the world's largest private military base, a fleet of 20 aircraft, including helicopter gunships. It's become nothing short of the Praetorian Guard for the Bush administration's so-called global war on terror. And it's headed by a very right-wing Christian activist, ex-Navy SEAL named Eric Prince, whose family was one of the major bankrollers of the Republican Revolution of the 1990s. He himself is a significant funder of President Bush and his allies. And what they've done is they've built a very frightening empire near the Great Dismal Swamp in North Carolina. They've got about 2,300 men actively deployed around the world. They provide the security for the U.S. Diplomats in Iraq. They've guarded everyone from Paul Bremer and John Negroponte to the current U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad. They're training troops in Afghanistan. They've been active in the Caspian Sea, where they set up a special forces base miles from the Iranian border. They really are the front line in what the Bush administration viewed as a necessary revolution in military affairs. In fact, they represent the life's work of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld.
What do you mean, the life's work?
Well, Dick Cheney, when he was defense secretary under George H.W. Bush during the Gulf War, one of the last things he did before leaving office was to create an unprecedented lucrative market for the firm that he would go on to head, Halliburton. He commissioned Halliburton to do a study on how to privatize the military bureaucracy. That effectively created the groundwork for the absolute war profiteer bonanza that we've seen unfold in the aftermath of 9/11. I mean, Clinton was totally on board with all of this, but it has exploded since 9/11. And so Cheney, after he left office, when the first Bush was the president, went on to work at the neoconservative American Enterprise Institute, which really led the push for privatization of the government, not just the military. And then when these guys took office, Rumsfeld's first real major address, delivered on September 10th, 2001, he literally declared war on the Pentagon bureaucracy and said he had come to liberate the Pentagon. And what he meant by that, and he wrote this in an article in Foreign Affairs, was that governments, unlike companies, can't die. And he literally said that. So you have to figure out new incentives for competition. And Rumsfeld said that it should be run more like a corporation than a bureaucracy. And so the company that most embodies that vision, and they call it a revolution in military affairs, it's a total part of the Project for a New American Century and the neoconservative movement. The company that most embodies that is not Halliburton, it's Blackwater.
Explain what you understand happened on Tuesday, President Bush giving his address, the Blackwater helicopter crashing.
Well, I think a lot of people, even though I think there's been a lot of reporting on it and it has been out in the public sphere, I think a lot of people still would be surprised to know that the U.S. ambassador in Iraq and the U.S. diplomats throughout Iraq and U.S. diplomatic facilities and regional occupation offices are actually guarded by mercenaries. And Blackwater has a $300 million contract to provide diplomatic security. And so they guard Zalmay Khalilzad and other U.S. diplomats in Iraq. Well, what we understand, and of course, as you know, reports are always very shaky in the early stages, is that a U.S. diplomatic convoy came under fire in a Sunni neighborhood of Baghdad, and a Blackwater helicopter apparently landed to try to respond to that attack, because Blackwater and its Little Bird helicopters provide the security for diplomatic convoys, and they got engaged in some kind of a firefight on the ground, and four men from one helicopter were killed. Then another helicopter responded and was brought down either by fire or it got tangled in some wires. Four of the five men who worked for Blackwater that were killed were shot in the back of the head, according to reports. And what's interesting about this is that Zalmay Khalilzad said that he had traveled with the men, and then said that he had gone to the morgue to view their bodies. And he said that the circumstances of their death were unclear because of what he called the fog of war. But I think it's very possible that they were guarding a very senior diplomat, if not Zalmay Khalilzad himself. I mean, we don't have evidence to suggest that, but the fact that Khalilzad really came out forward and said, these were fine men, I was with them and visited them in the morgue, indicates that it could have been a very serious attack on a senior official.
What do you think is the actual body count in Iraq of U.S. soldiers? I mean, we count them very carefully. You know, when it surpassed 3,000, this was extremely significant. What really is the number of U.S. Military dead?
Military dead is, I think it's interesting because the lines have totally been erased. I would say that that we should be counting the deaths of Blackwater soldiers in the total troop count. I mean, I filed over the last year a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests, and one of the ways that we have found to discover the deaths of the number of contractors that have been killed is actually through the Department of Labor, because the government has a federal insurance scheme that's been set up, which is actually very controversial. It was grew out of something called the Defense Base Act, and it's insurance provided to contractors who service the U.S. military abroad. And so as of late last year, more than 600 families of contractors in Iraq had filed for those benefits. So I think we're talking somewhere in the realm of, and these are just U.S. contractors that have rights to federal benefits inside of the United States. Remember, it's not necessarily Americans that make up the majority of these 100,000 contractors that are operating in Iraq right now, 48,000 of whom are mercenaries, according to the GAO. So I don't think it's possible to put a fine point on the number of troops killed, because the Bush administration has found a backdoor way to engage in an undeclared expansion of the occupation by deploying these private armies. And at the State of the Union address the other night, Bush announces this Civilian Reserve Corps, which is gaining momentum among Democrats and others. Wesley Clark has talked about it, the former presidential candidate and supreme allied NATO commander. But what that is another Frankenstein scheme that Cheney and these guys cooked up in their outsourcing laboratory to engage in an undeclared expansion. I mean, on the one hand, we have Bush talking about an official U.S. troop surge. The Army, a few months ago, when Colin Powell said that the active duty Army is basically broken, the Army was calling for 30,000 troops over 10 years. Bush then announces in his State of the Union 92,000 active duty troops over 5 years. And at the same time, they're increasing the presence of the mercenaries, increasing the presence of the other contractors, talking about some privatized or civilian reserve corps. This is all an undeclared expansion of the U.S. occupation, totally against the will of the American people and the world.
Civilian Reserve Corps.
Right. That's what they're calling it. And you know, I mean, a lot of what has been tossed around about this since 2002 has been envisioning a sort of disaster response, international aid. You know, it's all very benign sounding. But the context of it, when Bush announced the other night, he said we need 92,000 troops and we should develop a Civilian Reserve Corps to supplement the work of the military. Now, what's interesting, Amy, is that 2 years ago, Eric Prince, the head of Blackwater USA, was speaking at a military conference. He only comes out of his headquarters to speak in front of military audiences. He does not speak in front of civilians. He's on panels with top brass and others. He's very secretive. He gave a major address in which he called for the creation of what he called a contractor brigade. And I can read you what he said. He said, this was 2 years ago, before Bush called for his Civilian Reserve Corps. Eric Prince, head of Blackwater USA, there's consternation in the Pentagon about increasing the permanent size of the Army. We want to add 30,000 people, and they talked about costs of anywhere from $3.6 billion to $4 billion to do that. Well, by my math, that comes out to about $135,000 per soldier. And then Prince added, we could do it certainly cheaper. And so now you have Blackwater, the Praetorian Guard for the War on Terror, itching to get into Sudan. You know, something happened last year that got no attention whatsoever. In October, President Bush lifted sanctions on Christian Southern Sudan, and there have been reports now that Blackwater has been negotiating directly with the Southern Sudanese regional government to come in and start training the Christian forces of the south of Sudan. Blackwater has been itching to get into Sudan, and Eric Prince is on the board of Christian Freedom International, which is an evangelical missionary organization that has been targeting Sudan for many years. And there's a political agenda that Blackwater fits perfectly into, whether it's Iraq and Afghanistan or Sudan.
And the other connections, Jeremy Scahill, between Blackwater and the Bush administration and the Republican Party?
The most recent one is that President Bush hired Blackwater's lawyer, Blackwater's former lawyer, to be his lawyer. He replaced Harriet Myers. His name is Fred Fielding, of course, a man who goes back many decades to the Reagan administration, the Nixon administration. He's now going to be Bush's top lawyer, and he was Blackwater's lawyer. Joseph Schmitz, who was the former Pentagon Inspector General, whose job it was to police the war contractor Bonanza, then goes on to work for one of the most profitable of them, is the vice chairman of the Prince Group, Blackwater's parent company, and the general counsel for Blackwater. Ken Starr is now Blackwater's, the former Whitewater prosecutor, the man who led the impeachment charge against President Clinton. Kenneth Starr is now Blackwater's counsel of record and has filed briefs for them at the Supreme Court in fighting against wrongful death lawsuits filed against Blackwater for the deaths of its people and U.S. soldiers in the war zones. And then perhaps the most frightening employee of Blackwater is Kofor Black. This is the man who was head of the CIA's counterterrorism center at the time of 9/11, the man who promised President Bush that he was going to bring bin Laden's head back in a box on dry ice and talked about having his men chop bin Laden's head off with a machete, told the Russians that he was going to bring the heads of the Mujahideen back on sticks, said there are going to be flies crawling across their eyeballs. Kofor Black is a 30-year veteran of the CIA, the man who many credit with really spearheading the extraordinary rendition program after 9/11, the man who told Congress that there was a before 9/11 and an after 9/11, and that after 9/11 the gloves come off. He is now a senior executive at Blackwater and perhaps their most powerful behind-the-scenes operative.
And electoral politics?
Well, Eric Prince, the head of Blackwater, and other Blackwater executives are major bankrollers of the president, of Tom DeLay, Santorum. They really were. When those guys were running Congress, Amy, Blackwater had just a revolving door there. They were really welcomed in as heroes. Senator John Warner, the former head of the Senate Armed Services Committee, was called them our silent partner in the global war on terror. Eric Prince's sister, Betsy DeVos, is married to Dick DeVos, who recently lost the gubernatorial race in Michigan. But also, I mean, this is a family, the Prince family, that really was one of the primary funders. It was Amway and Dick DeVos in the 1990s, and it was Edgar Prince and his network, Eric Prince's father, that really created James Dobson, Focus on the Family. They gave them the seed money to start it. Gary Bauer, who was one of the original signers to the Project for a New American Century, a major anti-choice leader in this country, former presidential candidate, founder of the Family Research Council, he credits Edgar Prince, Eric's father, with giving him the money to start the Family Research Council. We're talking about people who were at the forefront of the right-wing Christian revolution in this country that really is gaining steam despite recent electoral defeats. And what's really frightening is that you have a man in Eric Prince who is a neo-crusader, a Christian supremacist, who has been given over $500 million in federal contracts, and that's not to mention his black contracts, his secret contracts, his contracts with foreign-friendly governments like Jordan. This is a man who espouses Christian supremacy, and he has been given, essentially, allowed to create a private army to defend Christendom around the world against secularists and Muslims and others, and has really been brought into the fold. He refers to Blackwater as the sort of FedEx of the Pentagon. He says, if you really want a package to get somewhere, do you go with the Postal Service or do you go with FedEx? This is how these people view themselves. And it embodies everything that President Eisenhower prophesied would happen with the rise of an unchecked military-industrial complex. You have it all in Blackwater.
Jeremy Scahill, thanks very much for joining us, and look forward to seeing your book when it comes out. Jeremy Scahill's forthcoming book is Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Thanks for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Until the philosophy which old one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, miss a war that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, it is a war that until that day the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war. War. And until the ignoble and unhappy regime that hold our brothers in Angola.
War, Bob Marley here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon has unveiled one of its newest high-tech weapons of the future this week, a heat ray gun that's designed to make targets feel like they're about to catch fire. The gun's officially known as the Active Denial System, or ADS. It functions by firing an invisible high-energy beam from a large rectangular dish mounted on a Humvee vehicle. The beams are designed to penetrate clothing, then travel less than half a millimeter into the skin. Within seconds, the beam heats the skin to around 120 degrees. The Pentagon describes the ray gun as a safe, non-lethal weapon designed for crowd control. But critics question the safety of the weapon if used on crowds containing elderly people, children, or pregnant women. The weapon isn't expected to go into production for another 3 years, but the Pentagon's already launched a public relations campaign to win support for the experimental weapon. This is an excerpt from a promotional video produced by the Pentagon.
ADS uses a directed beam of millimeter wave energy that penetrates about 1/64th of an inch into the adversary's skin. The energy is harmless. The superficial heating effect is nearly instantaneous, and the adversary instinctively flees. ADS is an ideal choice for protecting members of the U.S. military and their equipment in a wide range of operations, particularly when the use of lethal force would be counterproductive. ADS utilizes groundbreaking technology that is designed to save lives, protect the innocent, and limit collateral damage while effectively repelling adversaries. ADS will minimize fatalities by providing our forces a non-lethal option between shouting and shooting.
Mark Erlasco of Human Rights Watch joins us in the studio, senior military analyst at the organization, expert on non-lethal weapons. Gary Anderson joins us on the phone, retired Marine colonel, defense consultant in Washington, D.C. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mark Erlasco, can you describe further this weapon and what your concerns are?
Well, one of the problems that we have is that I can't do a very good job of describing it to you. I've gone and met with a number of military personnel, gone down to actually have at conferences on the ADS, looked at video for footage on tests of the ADS, and spoken to a variety of military personnel on it. And yet they continue to hold back information from us. And one of the problems that we have is this veil of secrecy that they refuse to lift. We're not looking for any classified information on it, just for information basically to understand the legal and medical tests that have been undertaken on it. And so I really can't describe in full this weapon because of this veil of secrecy. And it's incumbent upon the military to really lift that veil now so that we can have that discussion and debate on this really novel technology.
What do you feel when you're hit with it? I mean, reporters have been hit with it.
Well, we've been told I haven't been shot with it yet. I'm sure that they're looking forward to getting me under the gun soon. I haven't been shot with it yet, but from the video that I've seen and from speaking to people who have been hit with it, it's an instantaneous heating, very quick, rapid, and you just want to get out of the way.
So it causes pain.
It does. It causes pain, absolutely. And one of the questions that we have for the military is, under international law, a weapon cannot legally be used which is designed solely to cause pain. And so we'd like to see how their legal definitions have been put forward on this weapon and what their legal response is to it.
Colonel Gary Anderson, is this a laser? And what about this point of the weapon to cause pain?
Okay, could I ask a question to your other guest first? If he has contacted the Pentagon since this, they've unveiled the weapon. They were under some strictures not to until they officially did. Apparently they have, since you have a promotional video. Could I get an answer from that?
Sure. Well, they've just unveiled the weapon this week, which doesn't give a lot of time for that. But I've been speaking to them for the last 2 years on the weapon. Sir, first I want to let you know that...
My question, I just wanted to make sure that we weren't miscategorizing the Pentagon's position now that they've updated. I'd suggest that you do contact them.
Well, Gary Anderson, is this a laser, and what about this issue of a weapon just designed to cause pain?
I think the promotion video probably described it as millimeter wave. It excites the upper level of the skin to a very small part, but it does inflict a sensation of pain that would cause you not to go any further if you were advancing toward an area. I've been hit by the thing about 56, 60 times, and... you get a sensation of pain, you don't want to go any further, it's an involuntary reaction, and then when you stop going, they turn it off and you're okay.
And when you say you get a sensation of pain, you mean across your body, it's this shock of heat, of burning?
It is a sense that you're very, very hot. It's like having an oven opened right in your face, and just like going close to a hot stove, you don't want to go any further.
What's the danger of a weapon like this being used during an interrogation session, being used for torture?
Any weapon can be misused if put in the wrong hands. The question I would ask you, each variation of this weapon costs about $8 million. Why in the world would I want to use an $8 million weapon to do something I could do with a 25-cent penknife?
Mark Alaska.
Well, first I'd like to say that Human Rights Watch supports the development of non-lethal weapons. We certainly think it's a good thing to not want to kill civilians. And the U.S. military currently uses a variety of non-lethal weapons. People have to understand that this is something that is currently in their toolbox. Things such as foams or pepper spray and even things like beanbag guns. And so these are things that they have right now. This weapon is a leap forward by generations. You know, really, Star Trek has taken over at this point. This is a novel weapon. It's new technology. And so at Human Rights Watch, we believe that it's time for an open debate. There needs to be discussion on it. And we would have hoped that over the last 2 years, as we've been working with the military to learn more about this weapon, that that would have happened. It seems now that they're trying to say, you know, the weapon's been authorized, we're going to develop it, and now you've got a couple of years to learn about what we're going to do with it.
Well, let's take those sort of point by point. First of all of the weapons that Mark described, with the exception of the foam, have the potential of leaving permanent damage. They're not designed to do that, but they can, and they have. It is against the Geneva Convention to deliberately inflict permanent harm on a person that you expect to survive. That's exactly why the ADS was developed. It doesn't do that, and it outranges any of the weapons that we have now. Right now, the slingshots and the small arms weapons that are concealed in crowds of pregnant women and children, as they were in 1993 in Somalia and in 2003 in Fallujah, can outrange any of these weapons that he just described. The ADS has a line of sight type thing to give you a standoff, so you don't put either your people or the opposition in undue danger. Now, let me also say that I do reemphasize the fact that now that the Pentagon has been able to unveil the weapon, I would encourage you to get together with them and open your dialogue. They're ready to have it now, and then if you still feel they're not being forthcoming, then you probably have a legitimate problem with it.
What about the long-term effects of this weapon?
As far as I know, there are none. The last time I was exposed to it was September of 2005, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm still alive, breathing, and feel pretty good, and just passed my last physical.
Mark Glasgow.
Well, I don't really think that 2005 is long-term. I appreciate what you're saying. There are certainly things that we need to learn about this. I went out to the labs and met with some of their folks. They were very reticent to share information. They were happy to have you, but, you know, they're not as open with the documentation as we would hope they would be. We have to understand non-lethal weapons, as you stated, certainly can kill at times. This weapon is not designed to do that. But there are other things that non-lethal weapons do as well. One of our concerns is that they lower the threshold of use. Let's say, for example, I'm a 19-year-old soldier holding an M16 and I have a crowd in front of me. You know, perhaps if I see women and children, I'm going to be less likely to pull the trigger on them because I know that I have the capability to kill them. But if I have a weapon in hand, which I know is not going to give permanent damage, or at least believe that, perhaps I'm more likely to use it. And so we're concerned that it's not just the medical effects or the lasting effects on people, but there are a variety of things non-lethal weapons do just by their nature that will complicate the battlefield.
Mark, I understand your concern, but I suffer from the advantage of having experienced that type of position and that type of decision-making close up in Somalia. And I will tell you this, I desperately wanted to have that capability as an alternative between doing nothing and having to fire into the crowd. Even if I was very, very precise with my snipers, there was always a chance of killing an innocent. I wanted that ability to sort of set my phaser on stun. And I think any thinking soldier would want that. And I think the American public is going to understand that. So I welcome having this argument. Now that the Pentagon has allowed the scientists to talk about it, I really welcome this policy debate. I think the American public has an innate ability to understand common sense, and I think they'll side with my side rather than your side.
Yeah, I don't see it as an argument, nor do I see a need to have an argument. We're just looking for an honest and open discussion about it. In fact, when I first met with the military on the ADS 2 years ago, I said to them, look, you know, here's an opportunity to embrace your critics and to have us as a supporter. Explain the weapon system to us better, because we really think it's a good idea not to kill civilians, and potentially you've developed something here that has some very positive aspects to it. But we have legitimate concerns. Now, they've taken 2 years and dragged their feet. As you state, they've now unveiled the weapon. I think it's incumbent upon them, though, to allow that debate, to have that debate before a weapon is given the thumbs up and put into production.
Do you think, Mark?
I think they've opened up that debate, Mark. I think what you need to do is engage with them, and let's go ahead and have that debate.
Do you think, Mark Glasgow, that this new heat ray gun has signaled a new direction in non-lethal technology?
Well, absolutely. We've gone now. There's been a huge leap in non-lethals from the very short-range non-lethal weapon that leaves marks, and now all of a sudden we have things that are novel technologies, things that are not going to be stopped under certain international laws, or I should say that are not going to be governed by certain international laws on weapons. And so we're going to look at the broader Geneva Conventions covering them. You know, for example, there is no treaty body that is going to govern them specifically. So we have to look at international law more broadly. And so since they're a completely new level of technology, we really have to take a look at them very carefully. And as you stated, it's not understood the long-term damage effects. 2005 is not a good bellwether. We don't really understand the ocular damage that it can do to someone. And as also stated before, pregnant women, children, the infirm, these are all people that are going to be far more susceptible to lasting damage. And there needs to be more understanding on the part of the public as to what the effects of this weapon are.
Okay, I think, Mark,
Colonel Anderson,
I agree with you there, but the one thing I want to point out is that we're dealing with adversaries who are deliberately putting women and children into those situations to mass gunmen and so forth. It's called asymmetric warfare, and they do it very well. Not having the ability to deal with that in a non-lethal manner is, in my mind, criminally irresponsible.
I mean, stun guns, for example, were talked about as non-lethal technology. And, of course, we see case after case and being used in domestic situations, police on people here in the United States where people have died.
That's correct. And they continue to be used. We're talking now about not an individual. This is a crowd control weapon. We're talking about a large number of people. I was out at Penn State University last year, which is one of the labs that works on active denial system. And I learned that one of the problems that they've been working with is the bounce effect of the weapon, where if you're firing the weapon and it hits off of an acute angle, that in fact it could be directed in ways that you know, a scatter ability that they may not intend. And so there are a lot of potential. That means that the weapon can hit one spot and it can ricochet off and go much farther than it's intended. And so we're just concerned about the development of policies, procedures, and the way the weapon is employed. The training of the soldiers, this is something completely new that these kids are not going to be initially understanding. They have to learn how to use it. And also looking at the possibility of the weapon cutoff. You know, as I understand it currently, when the weapon is first employed, there's a safety mechanism in which it shuts off very rapidly so that the people are not, you know, on fire for a long time, or at least have that sensation for a long time. The concern is override. What about the possibility of a lengthening of this period? So that the people are actually exposed to it for a longer period, can an adversary fight through it? And so there are a lot of things going on here. It's far more complicated. And while I appreciate what the colonel says, that we want to minimize civilian casualties, and we at Human Rights Watch believe that as well, it's far more complicated than just saying you either have the opportunity to be shot with a bullet or to be uncomfortable.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you both for being with us, Mark Galasko of Human Rights Watch, and I also want to thank retired Marine Colonel Gary Anderson joining us from Washington, D.C., defense consultant. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Yes, this is Gary.
Designed to fill your mind now that you realize the prize.
Fight the power, public enemy, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report, we're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR, and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, also on public access TV, PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks. Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk now about police in California, New York, and Florida arresting eight former Black Panthers earlier this week on charges related to the 1971 killing of a San Francisco police officer. Richard Brown, Richard O'Neill, Ray Boudreaux, and Henry Watson Jones are arrested in California. Francisco Torres was arrested in Queens, New York. Harold Taylor was arrested in Florida. Two men already in jail, Herman Bell and Jaleel Muntakim, were also charged. A ninth man, Ronald Stanley Bridgeforth, is still being sought. The men were charged with the murder of Sergeant John Young and conspiracy to commit murder for a string of attacks on other officers. Harold Taylor and two other men were first charged with the murder of the police sergeant in 1975. But a judge tossed out the charges. Taylor and his two co-defendants said they made false confessions after police in New Orleans tortured them. Joining me now are two attorneys who are involved in this case. Stuart Hanlon is in San Francisco. Michael Warren is with me here in New York. Stuart Hanlon represents Herman Bell, and Michael Warren represents Francisco Torres. Michael Warren, let's start with this latest news of the arrest.
Yes. Mr. Torres was arrested the first part of this week at his home in Queens and taken to court. Actually, was taken initially to the One Police Plaza, then taken to court where he appeared on an extradition warrant, the initial stages of an extradition warrant hearing. Extradition was not waived. We are fighting extradition. And we are now awaiting a governor's warrant, which is supposed to be produced by the state of California. The case has been adjourned to March 6 for the production of the governor's warrant.
Stuart Hanlon, the background on this case. I mean, we're talking about a police killing in 1971. This is well over 30 years later.
Well, the background pretty much is the case occurred, you know, it was a pretty awful crime of assassination of a policeman who was sitting in a station. But the point was they didn't have any evidence, and they investigated, and they tortured witnesses in New Orleans. They tortured defendants, and cases were thrown out because of torture. And people have to understand this is actual torture with cattle prods by New Orleans policemen, where San Francisco policemen were sitting outside the room, obviously knowing what was going on, to get information. And we've learned, certainly in the last couple of years, around the world, in Afghanistan and Iraq, torture doesn't lead to the truth. It leads to what the torturers want to hear. And that's what they got, false statements, false confessions. And judges across the country threw these statements out for various reasons, the bottom line being torture, and the case seemed to have ended. They couldn't find the people who had actually done the crime. And that's the background where the police started investigating again pretty seriously about 5 or 6 years ago.
I want to play for a moment an excerpt of a new documentary called Legacy of Torture, The War Against the Black Liberation Movement. It was produced by the Freedom Archives. The documentary includes interviews with Harold Taylor and John Bowman about being tortured by police in New Orleans, as well as dramatized scenes depicting the abuse they suffered. Taylor was arrested Tuesday for the killing of the San Francisco police officer. Police allege the late Bowman was also involved in the killing. He died in December. This excerpt begins with Harold Taylor.
I was in there for maybe 5 minutes, and the door opened. Three police officers in New Orleans came in, drugged me up by my heels, took me to a chair, where they handcuffed me to the chair and handcuffed my ankles, my feet to the bottom part of the chair. Without asking me any questions, they commenced beating me. They beat me, they punched me, they kicked me, they spit on me. They called me a lot of vile names. And then they told me that they was going to kill me if I didn't cooperate with them.
The New Orleans Police Department would come into the room where a hot blanket would be taken from the bucket, dripping, hot and wet, placed over my head, held there for, I can't say, whether it was minutes or seconds. It felt like forever.
They came out with a plastic bag, put it over my head. And they started beating me with the bag over my head. About time I was about to lose consciousness, about to pass out, they'd snatch the bag off. And while I'm trying to catch my breath, they would start beating me again. So I asked them, I said, well, what do you want? You know, they just continued on with it. They didn't ask me any more questions. They didn't ask any questions, really. Then they came out with this cattle prod. I knew what it was because being off of a farm when I was a kid, I used to, my family used to go to Louisiana every year to work the little family farm. And my uncles, they had a couple, we had some cows, and they used cattle prods to move those cows up chutes and stuff like that. So I seen that and I knew what it was.
The cattle prod was placed on my genitals, placed in my asshole, placed under my feet, placed under my arms.
Down in my private parts, under my neck, behind my ears, down my back. I think I passed out one time. They woke me back up, and they was taking me to another room. Two detectives had me by one arm, by each arm, and a detective came out of nowhere, and he just cold-cocked me and knocked me straight out. I was unconscious.
Another instrument that was used during the questioning was a ledger logbook, and this ledger logbook was used to hit me upside my head at times when I was not giving the right answers that was script for me.
They took me into a holding cell. They threw water on me. I was soaking wet. It was cold. Pulled me out of there maybe about 6 or 7 in the morning and told me they had somebody they wanted me to talk to, and I'd better cooperate, and if I didn't, I was going to get more of the same. So they put me in there. It was two detectives from San Francisco. I later found out it was McCoy and Ertelax. They started asking me questions, and they told me they had a script. I'm sure I saw a recorder there, too. And they was reading to me about what they said took place in San Francisco. I told them I had no knowledge of it. It's back again with the plastic bag. This time they had a blanket. I don't know what they soaked it in, but it was really, really hot. And they just covered me with that blanket and put that plastic bag over my head. And I couldn't scream, I couldn't holler, I couldn't get my hands up to poke a hole in the bag because I was handcuffed to the chair and my legs were tied to the chair. And they kicked the chair over and let me just suffocate. I was just about to pass out. They'd snatch it off, spit in my face, and they left me sitting there for a little while. McCoy and Ertelax, they started asking me questions, and I had no knowledge of the things they were asking me, so I couldn't answer them, you know. So they said, well, they turned off the recorder and whatever they had and said, well, we'll tell you what happened. And then after we tell you, this is what we want you to say.
So I did make statements. I did waive my rights to an attorney, which means I waived my Miranda rights. I did all of this because of the physical aggression and the brutality that was being put upon my body.
One got behind me and he took his hands and he slapped them like that over my ears. I couldn't hear nothing. My ears were just ringing so bad. I could feel fluid running down my side of my face. And they were talking to me, but I couldn't hear them. All I could hear was ringing. Whenever they stood me up to make me walk, I couldn't walk. They had to just kind of just carry me back into another room. And when they get me back in there, they start again. And they'd beat, and they'd beat, they'd beat. And then Ertelax, McCoy would come back in. And they would kind of grin and laugh. They were all laughing. They thought it was a lot of fun. And I was a big joke.
they started asking me questions. So I started talking to them. I'm doing just like they, I followed their whole script. Everything they told me to say, I said it just like whatever Reuben told them, I repeated what Reuben said.
Former Black Panthers Harold Taylor, who was just arrested, and John Bowman, who died in December. This is an excerpt of a new documentary called Legacy of Torture, The War Against the Black Liberation Movement, produced by the Freedom Archives. Stuart Hanlon, I wanted to ask you about court papers filed in the case that were released Thursday, indicating a fingerprint on a cigarette lighter, shotgun shells, and informant helped to lead to the arrest this week. An affidavit filed with the court said in 2004, an FBI investigator matched 5 of the 15 shotgun shells recovered from the crime scene to spent shells recovered from a shotgun found at Herman Bell's New Orleans home in 73. But police are now saying they've since lost the shotgun allegedly found at Bell's house. Your response?
It's fabricated evidence. What they're really saying is we found a gun at Herman Bell's house, and we took it to New Orleans, and we test-fired it, and we sent the shell to San Francisco 30 years ago, and all of a sudden we found out they match. But you can't test it. You can't test the truth of our allegations because we lost the guns, we lost the paperwork, we lost the proof of where we got it, we lost everything but the result. And just trust us that we're not biased, that we're fair, that we're going to produce real evidence in court. Trust us, and it's a joke. It really was for the media and the public and not for court.
The San Francisco Chronicle is reporting that ex-Black Panther Reuben Scott is expected to testify against the arrested men. He was arrested with Harold Taylor and John Bowman right. In 73 in New Orleans. In the mid-70s, Scott said he only agreed to speak to the police after he was repeatedly tortured. Can you talk more about Scott and his expected testimony?
Yeah, Reuben Scott was tortured in the same way Bowman and Taylor were. They tortured him and broke him. He wouldn't testify at first, and then they went and got him again and threatened him on a case in New York. And he agreed finally, as a broken man and a tortured soul who had been the victim of torture, to testify. We have statements from him that media took and he gave to lawyers where he contradicts everything he's going to say in court, where he said it because he was tortured. And in the document you talked about, they admit he was tortured. So I don't think we're ready in San Francisco to convict somebody or a group of people where there are political motivations for the case on a witness who's been the victim of torture.
Michael so Warren, we're going to end with you. We only have a minute, but the larger context here, and can you talk about counterintelligence?
I certainly can.
Program.
People ask the question, why pick up these men after they've been around, have not attempted to elude the authorities, have led productive lives all these years? The reason why is simply this. There are two questions that are very instructive. John Ashcroft, shortly after he was appointed the Attorney General, made a vow and a promise that he was going to go after as many ex-Black Panthers as he possibly could. And that's when this program was instituted. With respect to the Ingleside shooting and the killing of the police officer there was an attempt many years ago to lift a latent fingerprint. A latent fingerprint was lifted off of a lighter. There was an attempt to match it to my client, Francisco Torres, and a number of other people. Negative results. And those attempts continued all the way up until 2002. And the fingerprint technician said that he lost the when he checked the card, Francisco Torres, it was the wrong fingerprint card. So we have a lot of inconsistencies, but the most recent reason it relates to retaliation. These men, after being tortured and after the grand jury ended in 2006, went on the road with the Center for Constitutional Rights and talked about their torture, and we have seen some of that, and that's what this case is about.
Michael Warren, Stuart Hanlon, thanks for joining us. That does it for the broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shufo Dokadoos, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich, and Aramate, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Anna Nogueira, Anuradha Bhagwati, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.